On Verbatim Today, the third program in the six-part series, Premier's Past.
Hello and welcome to Premier's Past on ABC Radio National. I'm Andrew Dodd. And today it's Shane Stone, the Chief Minister of the Northern Territory between 1995 and 1999. Shane Stone was the man who tried to introduce statehood for the Northern Territory, but lost the vote at a referendum. He ran a hard-line law and order government, and often upset the Territory's Aboriginal population by opposing land claims. He took over as Chief Minister after the resignation of Marshall Perrin, on the same day that Perrin introduced a bill in Parliament to allow euthanasia. As a practising Catholic, Shane Stone had a very different view on the subject. Despite this, Perrin did not try to stop him taking over as Chief Minister.
He was disappointed in my position that I had adopted, and he told me so. I expressed to him a similar view at the time, that I felt that the whole issue had deeply divided our parliamentary wing, and that it would take many years to heal the divisions, because people do feel very strongly on this matter, one way or the other. But all that to one side, he didn't seek to stop me becoming his successor. He didn't stand up in the parliamentary room and express a view that I should not be the next Chief Minister. I recall very clearly he saying to the colleagues that it would appear that Shane has unanimous support to be the Chief Minister. And so I congratulate him. And we just moved on from there.
Nevertheless, you did have, in a sense, carriage of it, even though you were opposing the private member's bill that Marshall Perrin had put up. What was it like to be presiding over a parliament where, in fact, you were taking the opposite view, then when it gets successfully through with a vote of 13 to 12?
Well, it really did put the blowtorch on me then, because it was the classic illustration of you're damned if you do and you're damned if you don't, because there was an expectation that I would immediately move to overturn the legislation. And to the surprise of the anti-euthanasia people, and the naivety, I would suggest, I wasn't prepared to do that. I took the view that under the Westminster system, the Parliament had voted in a particular way. Sure, it only passed by one vote, but in taking on the role of Chief Minister and swearing the oath of office, I committed to uphold the legislature, its work, and the legislation that comprised my jurisdiction. And I would have thought that it would have been quite improper for me to simply then seize upon my new position in such an opportunistic way and say, well, it's over. Rather, we looked at ways of improving the legislation, and as history now records, it was subsequently overturned by the Australian Parliament, again ostensibly on a conscience vote.
Well, a bill was put up to repeal it by the opposition health spokesperson, Neil Bell, and you didn't allow the MPs within the CLP to have a conscience vote on that, and you voted against his bill that would have seen the Euthanasia Bill or Euthanasia Act repealed.
I saw that as a stunt. I didn't see that as a genuine conversation about the legislation that we had just debated so extensively and engaged the community in so widely. Rather, I did support amendments to the legislation, tightened up the legislation, and then in any event it was overturned. But, I mean, Neil Bell had been an old protagonist in the Parliament for quite some time. He saw an opportunity, the door was ajar, and he leapt in. There were a number on his own side who were equally emphatic that they would not support his bill either.
When John Howard announced that Kevin Andrews would introduce a private member's bill, this is on the 25th of June, to overturn the Northern Territory legislation, you described this as the most serious assault on the Northern Territory since self-government. Was that over-egging it a bit, do you think?
Not at all. The reality is that Territorians, having achieved self-government, were entitled to exercise that self-government. And if the legislation was to be modified, amended or repealed, that was a matter for Territorians and the Legislative Assembly of the Territory. It wasn't a matter, in my view, for the Commonwealth Parliament. Commonwealth Parliament would not have been able to intervene in any of the six states of the Commonwealth, but of course had this right within the Northern Territory and the ACT. The other perhaps untold aspect of this whole saga was that the Commonwealth had the right to disallow the legislation in between its passage in the Legislative Assembly and it making its way to the Executive Council and the Administrator. And Paul Keating opted not to interfere at the time. And I often wondered why he had not responded to the demands of his own colleagues in the Northern Territory to do precisely that.
Were you at this stage weighing up your Catholic principles against what you perceived to be your responsibility? And I ask this especially in the light of the fact that on the 22nd of September 1996, this is a few months after the law actually came into effect on the 1st of July 1996, Dr. Philip Nitschke injected Bob Dent and ended his life. So in fact, this legislation had had this profound effect. Were you then weighing up these two roles you had?
You can't step outside your faith, but you do try to balance your faith with your public responsibilities. I mean, it's a bit of a tight old dictum of render unto Caesar what is Caesar's and God's what is God. And it was difficult for me as a Catholic. And I have to tell you that I was vilified within my own church by some because I didn't and wasn't prepared to simply strike the legislation down. And this perplexed many of my fellow Catholics.
Well, the Federal Private Members Bill did proceed through the Parliament and, as we know, did eventually pass. I want to ask you about something you did on the 27th of October 1996 when you staged a protest, an act of remonstrance, it was described as, with the Chief Ministers of the ACT and of Norfolk Island. What were you doing?
There's the remonstrance. And, in fact, one of the original copies still hangs in my office in Darwin. And it was a process in which the Territory Parliament was able to present to the Speaker of the House of Representatives a petition of sorts, a remonstrance about the actions of the Commonwealth Government. It's a spelt-out process. And the document was a very large document and carried the signature of every member of the Legislative Assembly, including Neil Bell. The Speaker, polite as he was and all the rest, accepted the remonstrance, but the Commonwealth Parliament, in its wisdom, decided to ignore it.
After it was voted down, so in other words, after Kevin Andrews' Private Members Bill got up in the Federal Parliament, you called on the CLP, the Country Liberal Party, to order Nick Dondas and Senator Grant Tambling, the two CLP representatives in Canberra, to defect from the Federal Coalition. That didn't happen, though, did it?
I'm not altogether certain I called on their defection, but rather to sit outside the party room at the time to make the point that either we had the carriage of our own destiny or we did not. I mean, CLP federal members in the Senate and the House of Representatives had always been very robust and vigorous in defending the independence of the CLP, and both Dondas and Tambling voted against the Andrews legislation, consistent with what the CLP requested of them. I mean, we were affronted, we were disappointed, and we weren't going to go down without a fight. These were matters for Territorians to determine. Whether you believed in euthanasia or not, this was a matter for our Parliament.
You had said when you entered, when you took on the role of Chief Minister, that you wanted to see a more urbane and sophisticated form of politics in the Northern Territory. Was this undermined when your Health Minister, Fred Finch, not long afterwards, came up with a plan to send heroin addicts on one-way bus trips down to the south and at the same time refusing to set up a methadone program?
Well, Fred certainly got a lot of publicity at the time, and he was carrying a message that we were cleaning up our own backyard. I mean, it would be no secret that I ran a a very high-level law and order government. And we didn't have a methadone program. And whilst we might still debate the rights and the wrongs of methadone programs, injecting rooms and the like, I was not persuaded that there was any merit in such programs. And we certainly weren't encouraging people from outside of the territory with these issues to move into our community. Make no apologies for that. Very hard-line position, not only on drug offences, but also on a range of other matters.
Let's move forward to November 1995. There was the third coronial inquest into the Azaria Chamberlain case at that time, and it delivered an open verdict not long afterwards. Did you feel like this issue would never go away? And did you ever feel the need to apologise? And will you ever apologise for what happened to the Chamberlains?
Well, it's an interesting connection that I have with the Chamberlains, because her original solicitor was a fellow called Peter Dean in Alice Springs. And as I arrived in Alice Springs from Melbourne, I took over his practice, or part of his practice, including the file on the Chamberlains. So that was my first real encounter with the whole issue. Now, I didn't have it for very long. It was subsequently uplifted and moved to another law firm. But I then had to encounter the issue again when I was in Cabinet as a minister in the Perrin government. And I recall Marshall coming into the Cabinet room and relaying what had occurred and indicating there was very little choice, that she was to be released. And so it was done. There was no real discussion about it. It was an acceptance of what the findings were. I don't believe I ever had any representations or contact with the Chamberlains in the intervening period leading up to my retirement from the Parliament.
But at the time, if they'd asked you for an apology, would you have given one?
Well, I'm not altogether certain that, you know, this... I mean, we see it all the time, apologise for this, apologise for that. I don't think it takes us anywhere. I believe there was some issue of compensation which was dealt with. If people need an apology, then you weigh it up. But in fact, I'd have to tell you, I'm not even aware that they ever sought an apology at that time.
Upon assuming the office of Chief Minister, you said that there would be statehood in the Northern Territory by 2001. It didn't happen, did it?
No, my greatest disappointment, and it will probably never happen in my lifetime. And hugely disappointed at the way it panned out. And I mean, the reality is that I stood in the Parliament and took it squarely on the chin and accepted responsibility. It had happened on my watch. The campaign had failed only just, but there's no second prize in referendums or general elections. You either win or you lose. I recall John Howard ringing me and asking, did I see any merit in running an argument that notwithstanding the Commonwealth Parliament should press on regardless. That had happened in the ACT, where there had been a vote against self-government, but they received self-government anyway. I took the view that no, democratic process had applied, we'd lost, there would be no statehood for the Northern Territory. And it was a huge personal disappointment, and one that I've often thought about in the subsequent 10 years.
Well, of course, you're referring there to the referendum that was held across the territory on the 3rd of October 1998, when the vote to declare the territory a state was defeated 51.9% to 48.1%, so quite a close vote. This had come out of a convention where the convention had recommended three questions be put to the Northern Territory population. You took the decision that that should be conflated or put together as one question. Was that part of the reason, do you think, why the vote eventually failed?
You pore over these issues and you pose the what ifs. The reality is that the process was not controlled by us. It was controlled by the Commonwealth Parliament and the government of the day. And it was their disposition there should be one question and one question only. And I deferred to their judgment on that. I know that it was subsequently dressed up that I had circumvented the three questions being asked. Not entirely true. I had a very unique opportunity and window with a Prime Minister in John Howard who was prepared to give us an opportunity to decide whether or not we wanted to be a state. I was well aware that the vast majority of the federal cabinet did not support the move. But John had invoked his personal authority as Prime Minister to give us the opportunity, perhaps in haste, perhaps in my rush, to seize the moment, to get us underway. It may have been a mistake. Certainly the opponents of statehood made a big deal of it, that they were being denied the right to address the three questions that the convention had put forward. But again, I make the point that the convention and the territory government were not in charge of the process. It was a Commonwealth function to determine whether or not we would ultimately become a state and on what terms.
There was that famous headline after the result. I think it went, "I failed," in Shane Stone's words. What was it that you did that added up to failure? What did you do wrong?
I moved too quickly. I asked my wife this, why has this gone off the rails? And she said, you didn't take the people with you. They thought it was some sort of a trick. They thought that you were going too fast. And that was probably right. But I was going fast for a reason. I had a Prime Minister who was prepared to entertain it. I mean, everybody else had laughed me off on the whole issue of statehood, whether it had been Hawke, Keating. Here I had John Howard saying, I'll give you a shot. And I didn't communicate effectively enough to the people that this was a once in a lifetime opportunity. But of course the other factor playing out in all of this, and it's been clearly documented along the way, that the very powerful land councils were never going to support statehood, ever, and still don't to this day. I mean, I've often sat and talked to some of the senior Indigenous people. I say, it doesn't serve our interests for the Northern Territory to be a state. And I understand the arguments. I can understand why they would see statehood as a threat to the role of the land councils and the way that they operate in the Northern Territory. So there were a lot of things at play. The opposition, of course, they saw an opportunity to bring me down a peg or two. And whilst they said publicly they would campaign for statehood, they didn't. And there were many, many examples of prominent ALP people standing on polling booths, handing out the no card, including in my own electorate. So people were talking out of both sides of their mouth. We didn't have a unified position, and we didn't have a unified position because we were not prepared to roll over to some of the many demands that were being made as to what would be in the Constitution of the Northern Territory going forward. The irony in all of this is if you look at the chronology and the time frame, had Territorians voted yes, they would have ultimately found their constitution being dealt with in the Commonwealth Parliament by a coalition government that had the control of both the House of Representatives and the Senate. And that would have overcome many of the concerns on the Conservative side that we might have ended up with a constitution in any event that contained aspects of and provisions that were quite contrary to what the Territory was all about.
So a missed opportunity.
Hugely missed opportunity. I mean, that's the nature of public life. You have a swing. I mean, you can be a status quo politician and simply go with the flow and keep an eye on the next election and that's all you're really interested in. Or you can have a go. And I was of the latter type. I was prepared to have a swing and this was such a disappointment.
Is it so surprising that the land councils came out opposed to it? I know they have very real reasons why they would want to keep under a Commonwealth regime, but the relationship with your government had often been quite dire. You describe, for example, the Larrakia land claim over Palmerston and other areas as a greedy money grab, and there is that very famous quote that you used about Galarrwuy Yunupingu as being just another whinging black. Now, I'm using these as being emblematic examples of relations with the Indigenous community in Northern Territory that was not always favourable, was it?
Had not been during the entire course of CLP governments over some 27 years. And it came back to the fact that the Northern Territory had the Aboriginal Land Rights Act. No other state or jurisdiction had such legislation. So we'd become the social experiment for Australia in the north. And then we had the double whammy of native title. And successive CLP governments, and my own included, took the view that we were entitled to test the veracity of every claim that was made. And, I mean, we were proved right on numerous occasions where the wrong claimants would be found out, where other Aboriginal groups would be disadvantaged because, or if we had not tested the veracity of the claims. And yes, it is colourful up here. Galarrwuy Yunupingu, who is now a joint venture partner of mine in a mining project in the Northern Territory. We often look back on some of the descriptions we applied to each other. And I mean, it wasn't our finest moment. You actually misdescribed what I said. I said he was just another whinging, whining, carping black. There was a bit more colour in it. And I remember him firing back from an ABC studio, just another good-for-nothing redneck. And it was the robust style of engagement that existed up here. And yet, you know, when it was all said and done, I received, you know, laudatory letters from Aboriginal communities throughout the Territory on my retirement. I've maintained a close working relationship with Aboriginal communities in the commercial sector while I've remained in the Territory. So whilst this might be seen as terrible stuff through the prism of the South, it was all part and parcel of the robustness of the Northern Territory.
One of the most controversial things during your period of chief ministership was the introduction of mandatory sentencing. You look back on it now, do you think perhaps you went over the top a bit on that?
Didn't go far enough. Only applied it to property offences. I mean, you have to remember, I came out of a background of practising criminal law, both at the Victorian Bar and in the Northern Territory. So I knew precisely what I was doing. And I clearly had a clear understanding about the way the judicial system operated. The Northern Territory public had had a literal gutful of people breaking into their homes and stealing their property and committing a whole range of other offences. And when you map out the effects of mandatory sentencing, we had a dramatic decrease in crime. It was the same people committing the offences over and over again. I didn't go over the top. I didn't go far enough. I have a regret that I did not apply it to violent assaults.
What prompted your decision to retire, to edge out, move on in early 1999?
I had been a cabinet minister and chief minister then for a little bit over 9 years. And when I first came into the parliament, my wife and I had a very serious conversation about how long would this be for. And I said, I'll do this for a defined time. And she said, let's agree on a decade. And I'd reached a point where I probably used up most of my political capital, both with the electorate broadly, but with a number of my colleagues. And every day was a fight or a battle over an issue. And when you lose your passion and your enthusiasm and your sense of commitment, then you're better to move on.
Shane Stone, we'll leave it there. Thank you very much for talking to us.
Thank you.
Shane Stone, the former Chief Minister of the Northern Territory. Next time on Premier's Past, it's Bob Carr, the former Premier of New South Wales. Production today, Angie Grant. I'm Andrew Dodd. See you next time.
On Future Tense, some fascinating research on children and technology.
We thought that kids could give us a bit of a window into where things might be going, or what we're calling sometimes the near present, which is what's just right around the bend. And they gave us some material which looks like it's indicative of some things that are definitely coming loud and clear very soon.
A Window into Our Future. And you can download or stream this program from the Radio National website.